Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Matthew Marks, instructor of composition and literature in the UNO Department of English. He'll speak on the topic, Quantum Literature, How Poetry Can Help You Understand Physics. Mr. Marks' remarks were given as part of the Unorthodox Lecture Series, presented by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Student Organizations and Leadership Programs, where selected UNO instructors are invited to give lectures on favorite topics not necessarily directly connected with their chosen fields. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, March 14, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Elizabeth O'Connor, a member of the UNO student government.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to our Unorthodox lecture today. This is put on for you in combination from SULP and student government. And the goal of the series Unorthodox is to allow some of our professors to talk about a topic that they're passionate about and that would be interesting to students. And we want basically an upper level discussion about different topics around the university that you might not get to cover in classrooms very often. Hopefully, all of you have an evaluation form and a card, a little note card. At the end of the lecture, if you could help us by filling out the evaluation, that way we know what you got out of it and maybe what you're hoping for next time, that would be fantastic. And the little note card we gave you because this is an interactive lecture, and after Matthew is done with his presentation, we would like you, if you have any questions that you'd like him to talk more about, go ahead and fill out the note card and pass it in. And at the end, we'll have our student moderator, Erica, read some of the questions into the microphone for you. Thank you, Erica.
Our speaker today, Matthew Marks, began at UNO as an undergraduate English major 20 years ago. After studying medieval and Renaissance literature in England, he returned to UNO to earn a master's degree in Romantic through modern British literature. He has been teaching at UNO for the past 15 years. Although literature is at the core of Matthew's academic pursuits, his interests vary widely as he has taken keen interest in history, philosophy, psychology, and quantum physics, with a special interest in the current superstring theory, which has revolutionized the way many physicists and philosophers view the nature of physical reality. His teaching philosophy emphasizes the interdisciplinary nature of education, and he is the co-creator and coordinator of UNO's Synergy Project, which links courses from different departments together for mutual benefit. He has led many of these Synergy students, I among them, on historical, philosophical, and literary tours of Europe. He is currently working with the Honors Program and is developing a special interdisciplinary honors colloquium for the fall of 2012, which will examine the nature of truth from multiple academic disciplines. Much of Matthew's work involves finding parallels, structures, and symmetries between various branches of knowledge. His talk today is about how understanding the philosophy of English romantic poet John Keats can help students understand some of the more perplexing and seemingly paradoxical elements found in modern physics. So, with a round of applause, let's welcome Matthew.
Thank you, Erica. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to thank Ben Jagger and Liz O'Connor for organizing this event. This talk today is going to be on a couple of different subjects. The material is going to be a little bit difficult, and I've got limited time, so it's going to be useful to breathe deeply, center yourselves, and just take in as much as possible. I want to start by talking about the liberal arts. The classes that I teach, the synergy classes that I teach, combine different courses together for mutual benefit. Which I think is going to be the wave of the future in education, at least I hope so. The liberal arts are interdisciplinary in nature. I have students ask me sometimes, I'm an English major, why do I need to take a math course? Or I'm a biology major, why do I need to learn how to write a research paper? Well, the beauty of the liberal arts is that students get an experience in a wide variety of subjects, regardless of their major. They become well-rounded and make connections that other people perhaps don't see. In my own synergy courses, connections between classes are made intentionally. That is, students are encouraged, that's a nice word for required, to make connections between disciplines. And I'm glad to see so many of my former Synergy students here today. This kind of education is where students are pushed, I mean really pushed, to have what are called those aha moments, to think in ways that open us up not only just to new ideas, but to new paradigms of thinking, ways of thinking about thinking. This is going to be the basis of my talk today. So this talk today is going to be about ideas and how understanding one kind of idea could be helpful in understanding another similar kind of idea, regardless of discipline. We will not be analyzing and interpreting full poems. We will not be solving mathematical equations. We're going to be talking about the ideas behind physics and literature. Some of the ideas are going to be fairly difficult to understand if this is the first time you're bumping into these, and for the sake of brevity, I'm going to go through them rather quickly, so I encourage any questions afterwards to clarify any information if necessary. So the two categories I'll be talking about today are early 19th century English poetry, or at least the philosophy behind early 19th century English poetry, and the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. If you're expecting to hear a poetry reading, you're going to be very disappointed. If you are here to understand physics, I may be going at a speed that might be a bit too quick, but that's just inherent in the nature of a talk like this. I began studying quantum physics when I was in my late teens, mostly because I was dissatisfied with the mechanistic and deterministic philosophies endorsed by Newtonian physics, and when my physics teacher in high school recommended that I look into studying Einstein, I learned that there was another way of understanding the nature of reality, and that was very exciting to me. Simultaneously, I began studying poetry, spurred on by my English teacher here in Omaha at Westside High School, a guy named Donald Coulterman, who opened me up to a sense of wonder through expressions of beauty and truth found in poetry. I experienced the same kind of wonder when I studied black holes, cosmology, and quantum mechanics, even though I realized that poetic truth and physical truth were two different things. I found the mental connections helpful in understanding each area. As a young student, I could feel and observe in my brain how becoming receptive to beauty, truth, paradox, and how reality works was happening all at the same time for me. This kind of thinking, I suppose, is encouraged by the interdisciplinary nature of the liberal arts, which is why I'm such a proponent for that kind of interdisciplinary education. So what does English poetry have to do with physics? Well, there are so many connections, but for today, I'm going to need to narrow things down a bit. The original title for this talk was something like The English Romantic Poet John Keats's Philosophy of Negative Capability and the Copenhagen Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. But Ben and Liz thought that this might drive people away rather than reel them in, and they were definitely right in that. So I've got you here. You're caught in the web right now. My thesis today is that studying the philosophy of poetry can help people understand some of the more unusual aspects of quantum mechanics. So this talk will be in two parts, one on poetry and the other on physics. Beauty is truth. Truth, beauty. That is all you know on earth and all you need to know. These words are the final lines of the poem Ode on a Grecian Urn by English romantic poet John Keats, 1795 to 1821, who was a philosopher poet. And by that I mean that his poetry could be applied to other areas and that they form the foundation of looking at the world from a distinct paradigm. One of these ideas is called negative capability, a term whose meaning is hotly debated and not at all agreed upon by literary critics. The definition for this term changes with each generation of literary criticism. Here is a quote from John Keats. This is in a letter he wrote to his brother George. At once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement. I mean negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Coleridge, another English romantic poet, for instance, would let go by a fine, isolated verisimilitude caught from the penetralium of mystery, from being incapable of remaining content with half knowledge. Why Keats called this idea negative capability is unknown, but it is possible that Keats was influenced by his studies in chemistry and that it refers to the negative pole of an electric current. Just like the negative pole receives the current from the positive pole, to be negatively capable as a human being is to openly receive information, impulses, and inspiration from the world that is full of paradoxical mystery, which could be reconciled or understood through art. And this is a tough definition. The word verisimilitude means the quality of reality or truth, and the word penetralium means the innermost or secret part of something. This is a difficult quote and concept to understand, not just because of the antiquated language, but because the idea is so difficult to pin down. Here are some interpretations. In her book titled Keats and Negative Capability, literary scholar Lee O interprets negative capability this way. At the center is a great poet's capability of remaining negative, in a sense of being able to resist the instinctive clinging to certitude, resolution, and closure in the firm belief that great poetry is marked by its allowance for full-scale human experience that is too copious and diverse to be reduced to a neatly unified or conceptualized system. To be negatively capable is to be open to the actual vastness and complexity of experience, and one cannot possess this openness unless one can abandon the comfortable enclosure of doctrinaire knowledge, safely guarding the self's identity, for a more truthful view of the world, which is necessarily more disturbing or even agonizing for the self. American literary critic Lionel Trilling recognized that Keats's term also refers to an individual's ability to mentally internalize paradox. In other words, to see paradox not as a form of not as a irritable problem to be solved, but as a form of mysterious knowledge to be gained. Adding to Trilling's idea of negative capability, Keats biographer W.J. Bate further defines it as, quote, the ability to negate or lose one's identity in something larger than oneself, a sympathetic openness to the concrete reality without, an imaginative identification, a relishing and understanding of it. The great American writer F. Scott Fitzgerald's interpretation of this tricky term is in his autobiographical collection, The Crack-Up, where he describes negative capability this way. The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. So if there are any physics students in the room familiar with Niels Bohr, you may see where this is going. But for Keats, the poet, he was preoccupied with mortality. He was surrounded by death all of his life. His brother Tom died of tuberculosis. Keats himself died at the age 25 of tuberculosis, and he knew what that meant when he was sick, and his literary output toward the end of his life was incredible with someone struggling with such a horrible illness. And so he began to reflect upon the nature of life and death, of human mortality. And in his poetry, we see reflected his philosophy of these really big concepts of life and death. And essentially what Keats realized, a very mature way of looking at death, is that Keats, as a poet, loves life. This is a trait, I think, familiar to most poets in here, that you write about life, love, mortality. Those are your major themes. But what Keats realized is that death is a part of life. And it's the sweetest part of life because it makes us appreciate what life has to offer. And so Keats being alive, even with tuberculosis, is a beautiful thing. And that when his death happens, it will also be a beautiful thing because it's true. He has to accept and embrace the truth of his own mortality. And by embracing that truth, he recognizes it as being beautiful. Now, this may seem like a paradox. In dualistic thinking, you have light and dark and life and death. But for Keats, life and death become the same thing from a certain philosophical lens, from a wide enough philosophical lens, life and death become one thing. And this is paradox. But using a concept like negative capability, that is, embodying paradox, being in the heart of that mystery, you begin to recognize that there's no separations between life and death, and no separations between one thing or any other thing. It's a philosophical stance, a mental stance you take when faced with paradox, even the most difficult paradox of one's own impending death. So a great artist, writer, philosopher, engineer, teacher, psychologist, physicist, or whatever, would find it useful, I think, to realize that a full understanding of truth cannot fit into any, quote, neatly unified or conceptualized system. In essence, this means that in order to approach a full understanding of anything, a person needs to think outside the box by simultaneously holding in the mind some idea and the negation of that idea to internalize paradox and realize a truth is both truth and its opposite. Physicist Niels Bohr once famously said, "The opposite of a correct statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound truth may well be another profound truth." In poetry, such a profoundly truthful paradox may be something like beauty is truth, truth beauty. This kind of poetic truth is an understanding that the nature of reality is esoteric, even mystical in quality. This is what I mean by esoteric. It cannot be fully conveyed except by direct experience. You really have to experience something in order to understand it. That's an esoteric quality. This is usually different from something like mathematics, for instance, which is exoteric. It can be conveyed through the use of reason and the mind independent of experience. You can hold the idea 2 plus 2 equals 4 in your head without having to put apples in front of you on a table to do so. Quantum physics relies upon abstract mathematics for its equations, but it also includes direct experience or the participation or of an observer to explain its inner workings. I'll explain this in a minute. And so appears simultaneously esoteric and exoteric. This is not a problem for someone using Keats's concept of negative capability or something like it. In his famous Book of Five Rings, Japanese swords master Miyamoto Musashi, for instance, noted that when he teaches people martial arts, he, quote, generally makes them learn such things as having actual relevance to addressing deeper principles. There is no such thing as a distinction between esoteric and exoteric, end quote. So let's talk about some fundamental elements of physics which can benefit from these understandings exemplified by Keats's negative capability. There are so many to choose from, like chaos theory, Planck's law, Einstein's special and general theories of relativity, superstring theory, the Higgs boson, or God particle, something that physicists tend to chafe against, I think. But for the sake of time, let's do a quick tour through Albert Einstein's solution to the mysterious photoelectric effect, Schrodinger's wave equation, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics concerning wave-particle duality. Everybody get that? Okay. All right. In the mid to late 19th century, it was well known that ultraviolet light mobilized electrons to produce an electric current in metal. Essentially, you shine light of a certain frequency on a metal plate, and you get an electric current, that is, the electrons get ejected from the metal, creating electricity. The energy to free the electron charge must come from the light, but its mechanism was unknown until 1905, when Albert Einstein, inspired by Max Planck's idea of quantized packets of energy in atoms, imagined that light also could exist in little packets of energy, which were later called photons, a term I think most of you are probably familiar with. Up until this point, physicists thought that light existed as a wave, as described by Maxwell's equations, which show light bending around objects, diffracting, reflecting, and interfering. If you're ever walking down a dark hallway and there's a light on in a further room, you can see the light spilling out into the hallway and bending around the corner of the doorway. So what is light? He won the Nobel Prize, by the way, for the photoelectric effect, which most people think it was for the theory of relativity, but not so. So what is light? Is it a wave or is it a particle, like a little miniature photon torpedo? If a physicist were to set up an experiment to test this, he or she could find that it behaves as one and the other under certain circumstances. If you set up an experiment to measure its wave properties, such as passing it through a diffraction grating, it behaves as a wave. If you set up an experiment to measure its particle properties, it acts as a particle. This is the basis for Thomas Young's famous double slit experiment. Imagine a light source whose rays pass through two narrow slits in a screen. So with both slits open, you see the familiar dark and light stripes of an interference pattern. The stripes are lightest where the crests of the light waves amplify and darkest where the troughs and crests cancel each other out. If you're ever sitting in a bathtub and you drop your rubber ducky in front of you, you see the waves spread out. Well, just imagine that there's a plate with two slits in it. As the waves go through each of the slits, they're going to create an interference pattern. So light, we know, is a wave. However, if you send individual photons through the screen one by one, the photons continue to pile up into striped interference patterns. So how do the photons know whether to go through one or the other slit to build up an interference pattern? If you're quick, you could close one of the slits after the photon left the light source, or even after it has traveled through the slits, but before it hits the screen where it's recorded. In every case, the photons know whether there are one or two slits present at the time they went through. And even though only single photons are flying across, it appears as if each photon goes through both slits simultaneously and somehow interferes with itself. This appears paradoxical. But using thinking like negative capability, there are solutions. But first, it gets even stranger than this. If you put a detector in one of the slits so that you can determine if a photon actually went through that slit, well, then if you do this, then the interference pattern disappears and you are left with individual stripes on your screen. That is just two stripes on your screen. So when you're not looking at it, you get an interference pattern. When you are looking at it, the interference pattern goes away. It appears that the act of measuring or observing where the photon actually was determines whether it acts as a wave or a particle. Newtonian physics describes a reality independent of observation. It's exoteric and deterministic in nature. Yet if the act of measuring or observing the experiment changes the outcome of the experiment, then it appears to be esoteric in nature, that is, reliant upon experiential input of the observer. Perhaps it is both exoteric and esoteric simultaneously, which would appear paradoxical to a mind not able to use something close to the concept of Keats's negative capability. Now, I'm not asserting that poetic truth and physical truth are the same thing. I'm saying, however, that understanding poetical truth can help you understand physical truth, like wave-particle duality. So how can we say that where a particle is if it's also spread out as a wave? In response to this question, Austrian physicist Erwin Schrödinger developed what is known as Schrödinger's wave equation, which describes the probability of a particle being in some location while behaving as a wave. Wave functions are very difficult to understand because we find it hard to visualize them or even interpret them philosophically. In relying on probability rather than actuality, Schrödinger's model of an atom contains probability contours of where electrons are likely to be located in an atom. Chemists use this knowledge to engineer molecules, so for you chemistry students out there, this may be of special interest to you. Perhaps you've used a Schrödinger's wave equation in studying molecules. So Schrödinger's wave equation brings the wave-particle duality not only to atoms but to all matter. In fact, the double-slit experiment works not just with photons, but with electrons, which have mass, that is, things that comprise solid matter. The tables in front of you have electrons spinning around in them, and so they act as both waves and particles simultaneously. So in response to this... Schrödinger's wave equation brings the wave-particle duality not only to atoms but to all matter. Einstein was not particularly enthused about this idea. He is often quoted as saying, God does not play dice with the universe. Stephen Hawking says that God is an inveterate gambler who gambles at every opportunity he possibly can. German physicist Werner Heisenberg realized that quantum theory contained very strange predictions. It implied that experiments could never be done in complete isolation because the very act of measurement affected the outcome, which was expressed as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I'm going to skip over the mathematics of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, but it essentially says that it is impossible to know both the momentum and the exact position of a particle simultaneously. So neither the past nor the future behavior of any subatomic particle can be predicted with certainty. Now, philosophically, this would mean that determinism is dead, but that is for another lecture focusing on philosophy. For Heisenberg, quote, the path comes into existence only when we observe it, end quote. This challenges the fundamental paradigm of Newtonian physics, which assumes that the external world exists independently and can be revealed if only we look for the underlying truth. Quantum mechanics shows us that, for the atomic level at least, determining anything with certainty is meaningless, and that we can know only probabilities, no certainties. Physics was now squarely in the realm of abstract mathematics, where it resides today with the current superstring theory. And superstring theory is a mathematical theory which combines together the mathematics of quantum mechanics, this stuff here, and the physics of the very large, essentially Einstein's special and general theory of relativity, into a mathematical formula that works beautifully for all pieces of reality, regardless of scale. It makes certain assumptions. You have to live in an 11-dimensional, 10 or 11-dimension of reality, and that perhaps nothing and everything exists simultaneously. Talk about a paradox, right? And that it has not yet been tested because the scales are too small for that. So if we mix Heisenberg's explanation of the photo, Einstein's explanation of the photoelectric effect, Schrodinger's wave equation, and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle together, we would get something like what physicist Niels Bohr, a Danish physicist, called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, in which the experimenter, or the observer, is part of the outcome of his or her experiment. All probabilities for outcomes that are contained in Schrodinger's wave function crush down so that everything apart from the eventual outcome is lost. So according to Bohr, the original wave function for a beam of light contains all of the possibilities within it, whether the light appears in a wave or particle form. Because when you observe this, it appears in one form as a particle, not because it changes from one substance to another with the act of observation, but because it is truly both wave and particle at the same time. So by the act of observation, we collapse the wave function of probability into a particle of actuality by the very act of observation or interaction with physical reality. That's radical, right? Physical reality does not exist unless you, the observer, observe it. Until you observe it, it exists as a wave of possibilities. When you observe it, it becomes a particle of actuality. The inherent unknowability in quantum mechanics that arises from the lack of objectivity due to the observer's role in making quantum measurements creates a new paradigm in how we view the nature of reality. There is no reality without the observer. For some, this means that we need a conscious observer to collapse the wave function of probability into a particle of reality to make measurements on anything. Think of how that affects science, which is objective, right? You do an experiment, you fiddle with it. In quantum mechanics, you, the observer, are part of the experiment that you're doing. It's a whole new way of looking at physics. This may seem like an esoteric paradox, but using the mental abilities learned from the poetic truths revealed by philosophers like Keats and his negative capability, we can begin to reconcile this confusion. By holding what seems like paradox in the mind, by embodying paradoxical ideas like wave-particle duality or any of the other seemingly paradoxical ideas from physics, we can approach these topics with a mind employing the quality of negative capability. This, of course, takes time, takes practice, and study. So study your poetry and study your physics, but use poetry to understand physics and vice versa. The liberal arts encourages students to draw parallels between different disciplines. And when you see them, you begin to understand the world in which you live in a completely different paradigm. That, to me, seems like the pinnacle of education. Not just learning something to be regurgitated, but having a completely different understanding of how to approach the nature of what you're looking at in the first place. Anyone who is not shocked by quantum theory has not understood it, said Niels Bohr. So if you're not shocked yet, spend some time with it and see what happens. Thank you. Okay, are we going to gather some questions? I'm sure you have some. I hope you have some.
We have one question if you're ready to answer.
Okay, I think there might be a couple more coming back, okay. But sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you transfer this connection to other periods and genres of literature?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now, negative capability is just one poet in one time period. It's especially useful in studying physics because of his understandings of the nature of paradox. But because almost everything is transferable in some way or another with everything else, you just have to look for the connections. So there is a book called Quantum Poetics, which has to do with how quantum theory influenced poetry in the early 20th century. So most of the stuff is happening in the early part of the 20th century. And so writers like Yeats or Eliot, early modernists, were influenced by Einstein's ideas of general and special relativity. And so it goes back and forth as well. Now, that's a direct relationship because they're living at the same time and had a chance to reflect on each other's ideas. This idea here is taking a philosophy from Keats, early 19th century. He had no idea about quantum physics, right? He wasn't writing about quantum physics. But it is the ideas of how to approach knowledge that then can be transferred to understand quantum physics. So if quantum physics is really difficult for you, if you take a look at the wave-particle duality, and many of you are probably going, oh my goodness, you know, that's really, really difficult to understand. One way to begin to approach this is through poetry. When you begin to understand that you can embody paradox and find resolution with this idea of paradox, then the paradoxes that you find in quantum mechanics don't appear so paradoxical anymore. That is, you've changed your paradigm. Instead of looking at the wave-particle duality paradox one way, you simply shift over to another way of looking. It's kind of like the movie The Matrix when Neo is talking to the little kid with the spoon, right? And the kid is bending the spoon back and forth. And Neo says, wow, how do you do that? And the kid says, well, you realize the truth. It is not the spoon that bends, it's just yourself that bends. And so in trying to understand the nature of physical paradoxes like wave-particle duality or multidimensional space or multiverse theory or chaos theory or any of the other theories that come from physics, you, as a student, bend yourself a little bit. You approach it from a slightly different angle until the paradox doesn't seem so paradoxical. Right? And so I call these seeming paradoxes. A paradox is a problem with no solution. Well, these problems do have solutions. They only appear paradoxical from a certain point of view. You shift your point of view and get practice doing that, then the paradox seems to make sense. I mean, that's acquiring knowledge right there, I think. I mean, this is what Einstein was able to do so well, is to look at a problem from a different point of view. The photoelectric effect. He took Planck's idea of quantized energy packets instead of Maxwell's idea of waves and applied it to why we generate electricity when light is shined onto conductive metal. And with this idea that light is a packet of energy, a photon, rather than a wave, the solution presents itself. But then a new problem opens up. Well, it acts as a wave and a particle simultaneously. Paradox, not really, if you take probability into it using Schrodinger and Heisenberg to do this.
What do you see as the ramifications or consequences of the researcher becoming part of the research project?
That is a great question. That gets into really interesting territory right there. So let me give you a few ideas that other people have had. I'm not endorsing any of these ideas. I'm not endorsing the Copenhagen interpretation, by the way. I'm just showing that it's an idea that can be understood. But the ramifications, the potential ramifications of the observer being a part of the experiment, that is, there is no collapsing of the wave function until there is observation, could mean several things, and some of them get kind of radical. One thing it could mean is that physical reality does not exist the way that we think it exists. Now, we've got a table right here, and it's physical, right? You can touch it. Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher, says, we know the table is here because we can tap on it. Plato said, well, actually the table could be a shadowy manifestation of something greater, something what we would probably call spirit or unmanifested form, and that the thing that really exists is an idea or a consciousness, a universal consciousness that exists everywhere. That gets theological, right? Many people would call that God or the Tao or whatever, right? And so here we get a bumping of physics and theology together, which makes physicists squirm in their chairs and theologists say, ah, proof for the existence of God. There you go, right? But if the observer, that is the conscious observer, a person with a consciousness, and the consciousness is separate from the biological chemistry of our brains, and there's consciousness everywhere, consciousness is what exists, and what we perceive as being real or physical is a shadowy manifestation of that higher reality. Now, that gets pretty far out, right? I mean, that's one of the possible interpretations of this. Another would be multiverse theory. Now, if you've ever read the short story by Jorge Borges called The Garden of Forking Paths, he has an idea similar to this, in which everything, every choice that you make, every observation that you make splits off into an entirely different universe in which the only difference between this universe and the parallel universe is that you just made a different choice or you did a different observation. And so there'd be a near infinite number of parallel universe, multiple universes, but we have only access to this one because of the choices that we have made. This is a theory proposed in the 1950s. And is gaining popularity with superstring theory as well. Superstring theory and multiverse theory begin to come together a little bit. So that's a great question because it asks, what is the next step? So you do an experiment such as wave-particle duality with the double-slit experiment by Young, and then you have to ask the follow-up, what does it mean? And that, of course, is where there's lots of debate. You know, for physicists who want tangible proof using exoteric thinking, you know, they're going to get certain results and they want to be able to prove that sort of thing. But if the physicist, him or herself, is a part of the experiment by the act of observation, how do you separate yourself from the experiment if your input is necessary? That becomes esoteric. And so physicists are exoteric and esoteric. I don't know if they're like the new Buddhas floating around college campuses, you know, who are going to have these great realizations about the nature of time and reality, but that's where it seems to lead. You know, but again, I'm not a physicist, and so I have perspectives that maybe Dr. Wilkins is going to have very different perspectives on some of these things. but it's a natural follow-up question. What does it mean? And so for someone like Schrodinger, for instance, you may have heard of his famous cat, right? Schrodinger's cat. And Schrodinger did not like the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And the reason is he saw it as just being ridiculous. Imagine that you've got a box with a vial of poison in the box and a hammer hanging over the vial of poison. And you put the cat in the box with the unbroken vial of poison. And then you have a trigger on the hammer that will smash the poison, but the trigger is random. I think Schrodinger used a radioactive decay, something completely random, a Geiger counter, that if there were radioactive decay and the Geiger counter picked it up, the hammer would swing down, smash the poison, and the cat would be dead. No actual cats were harmed in this thought experiment. Okay. So you put the cat in the box, you close the lid, you stand back for 10 minutes and you observe the box. Now, according to the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, the cat inside the box is in a state of quantum flux. It is both alive and dead. A wanted poster, like an Old West wanted poster of the cat, would be a cat wanted alive and dead, right? Or dead and alive. But the wave function, Schrodinger's wave function, would not collapse. That is, it wouldn't become actual. The cat wouldn't actually die until you observe the cat. So while you're not looking at the cat inside the box, it is both alive and dead simultaneously in a kind of existence paradox. When you open the box, then the wave particle collapses by the act of observation, and then the cat is actually alive. You pick the cat up and you pet the cat, or the cat is dead and you dig a hole. Right? Now, Schrodinger used this to show that the Copenhagen interpretation was just ridiculous. But there are a couple of counter-arguments to that. One would be that the things we're talking about work at the quantum level, not at the level of cats. And the other would be, and I think a really good question, what is consciousness? What is the unit of consciousness? Could the cat observe itself dying and therefore collapse its own probability wave? Is there bacteria in the cat's eyeball that is, at some level, conscious, collapsing probability waves? So what is the level of consciousness necessary to collapse a probability wave into a particle of actuality? That's a good question. And so the more esoteric side of this gets into conversations about what is the nature of consciousness, right? Not just human consciousness, but is there universal consciousness? That way it goes theologically. The nature of human consciousness, is it something that exists inside our brains as far as like brain chemistry? Or is it something that exists independent of our physical nature? That would get towards something called the spirit or the soul, I suppose, if you're a religious person. So that brings up really interesting questions there.
Along kind of those same lines, a question asks, have you examined these ideas from a postmodern perspective? That is, there is no absolute truth.
Yes. I should say I am interested enough in that question to assemble the brightest minds from across the university together next semester in the Nature of Truth class that I won't be teaching. I will be leading. I am going to be a leader student in a class like that. And so at this point, in examining a lot of these ideas, I want to remain rather agnostic. That is, I don't want to make a choice right now and defend a position before I've gathered as much information as I can. And so if you're an honor student in the fall and you're looking for an honor seminar, Honors 3000, sign up for my Nature of Truth class, in which you'll get to engage in conversations with philosophers, with physicists, with people from political science and history about what is the nature of truth. And I'm hoping that we get this postmodern view of there is no absolute truth. That would be perhaps a correct answer, that there is no truth. It's a great question. What is truth? Now, when we look at quantum physics or poetry, are we looking at the same thing, much like particle wave duality, but just from a different lens of truth? And so how do we switch out those lenses in order to examine what is true? Not necessarily what is true and what is false, but do some truths lead to bigger truths from there? And so next fall will be an experiment in a group thinking with professors and students on these questions. And I'm really excited to, not necessarily to come to conclusions, but just to ask the right questions and sort of generate and brainstorm some ideas about this topic.
Okay, this is the last question I have. Okay. So if you do have something you'd like to ask, please pass it over. This person asks, what is your personal understanding of the idea that beauty is truth?
Yes. Yes, I like Keats's idea of negative capability because it seems to have worked for me in opening up avenues of understanding in other areas. And so when I bump into that poem specifically, it has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. Keats was not thinking of quantum mechanics when he wrote that. And there's different interpretations of the end of that poem. Is it the urn speaking, or is it Keats speaking, or what is the message from that? What's wonderful about poetry, and some of my poetry students are in here, thank you for coming, is one of the lessons that I teach in poetry is that what poetry is able to deliver is multiple answers. So when many people read a poem, they say, just tell me what it means. Why all the flowery language, right? Just give me the Cliff's Notes version of this. Missing the point that what a poem can do, what many poems do, is they offer two points of view simultaneously in one set of words, and both could be simultaneously true. And Keats is really, really good at this. He works at this to set up ideas that appear contradictory, such as being in love with death, seeing death as a fundamental part of existence and thereby embracing death rather than rage and rage against the dying of the light. He says, I am okay with death. He struggles against it like any person would. But intellectually, he understands that it's necessary, and because it's necessary, it's true, and because it's true, it's beautiful, and then should be embraced. I like that kind of philosophy. There seems to be a maturity or completeness in that kind of philosophy. So I will use it in the future when I'm studying physics or chemistry or whatever else and see what happens. It's a good way to get practice on switching perspectives, which I find very, very useful in education.
And the final question that I have is, how can we negate anything, and what is that?
To negate something. Yeah, how do you negate something? Well, with Keats, when you think of life, the negation of life would be death. You know, for Schrodinger, I suppose it's the same with his cat, right? You have an alive cat and a dead cat happening simultaneously in a probability wave. So that's one example of that, using the information that we've looked at today. So how do you negate anything? It's a mental idea. This idea of understanding paradox happens within the mind. You think of one thing and its opposite and find a way to combine them or make both true simultaneously. It takes practice to do this. Most people chafe against this. They want it either true or not, and that's it, right? Like a binary computer, ones and zeros. You want this or that. And with quantum physics, for instance, there's one and zero, and neither one or zero, and both one and zero, and all of that fits within a whole. And so it's taking a look at, instead of dividing things out into duality, you see monism, a kind of coming together of all knowledge. The great symbol for this that I think most people might be familiar with is a yin-yang symbol, right? The black and the white. There's a part of the black inside the white and a part of the white inside the black. Just symbolically, that tends to work really well to get people to understand a concept like that of something and its opposite, but contained within something that is whole. That's a mental leap that takes place within the mind of the student. That's why you're going to school, right? To stretch the mind and to think about these things. It can and does happen when you look at it enough, when you approach it from the right perspective. You get that aha moment. You say, ah, particle wave duality. I get it. I understand it. There is no paradox there. It seemed like a paradox before. You think about it differently. The paradox disappears, becomes non-paradoxical. I hope that made sense to at least some of you. It's a really difficult topic if this is the first time you're bumping into it, but hopefully, you know, as you walk across campus today, engage someone in conversation about this. Study up a little bit, you know, click around on YouTube a little bit and find some videos on particle wave duality and sink your brain into it. Just see what happens. Chances are you'll be richly rewarded for your efforts. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Matthew Marks, instructor of composition and literature in the UNO Department of English. He spoke on the topic, Quantum Literature, How Poetry Can Help You Understand Physics. Mr. Marks's remarks were given as part of the Unorthodox Lecture Series, presented by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Student Organizations and Leadership Programs, where selected UNO instructors are invited to give lectures on favorite topics, not necessarily directly connected with their chosen fields. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, March 14, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.